Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you on a new day this week. We're moving to Saturday. Hopefully, some of you are hearing us for the first time. Many others of you have followed us over from our old time slot on Sunday afternoon. So pass the word around to your friends. Hometown Heroes now airs every Saturday afternoon from 1 to 2 o'clock here on News Talk 580 KMJ. And, of course, online at KMJ580.com. Each week, we visit with local veterans of World War II to glean from their experiences during that most turbulent time in our world's history. Hopefully, record those experiences for posterity, honor the veterans for their service, and maybe learn a thing or two that might inspire us as we move on here in the 21st century now. Our guest this week, Don Meeker, lives in Fresno now, but around the time that Pearl Harbor was rolling around, he was up in the Pacific Northwest. And, Don, I like to start with a lot of the veterans by asking, what do you remember about December 7th, 1941, the day that America officially was drawn into World War II? Did you hear about it right away? And if so, what did it mean to you?
I think we could say right away, Paul, as I remember, I was a 17-year-old gas pumper in a Gilmore gas station in those days. My first customer that morning said to me, "Did you hear? The Japs have bombed Pearl Harbor." And I said, "No, I didn't hear that. Really, I had no idea where Pearl Harbor even was."
Mm-hmm.
But I'd guess that it was probably, I heard that, I'd guess it probably around 10 o'clock in the morning, Oregon time. That was in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Did you realize right away that it might be changing your life as you knew it?
No, I didn't. But after I heard about it from several more customers, I realized that it was a bit more serious than I'd first given it credit for.
And a couple of years later, you graduate from high school. And I've read some of your memoirs, and you describe it that you received your greetings from the Selective Service Administration in March of 1943. That's one way to put it, your greetings. That's a very friendly greeting, isn't it?
That, as I remember, was the very first word on the letter. That was the salutation. And I, at that time, I was employed as a journeyman shipfitter at a small shipyard in Portland that was building subchasers for the Navy. And I had learned how to read blueprints because I majored in drafting in high school in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could read blueprints, they qualified me as a ship fitter in a short period of time. I was making the munificent sum of $1.20 an hour when that happened.
Not bad in 1943.
43 was all right.
And your brother had been in the Navy for a while.
He had been, yes. He'd gone in peacetime in about 1934 and spent 5 or 6 years in the Asiatic Fleet aboard a destroyer. Then he was called back in the service in about 1940.
Did that influence your decision? Because as I understand it, when you went before this panel, they told you, well, you can be in the Army, the Navy, or the Marine Corps. We'll take you in any of those three, and you have your choice. And you said,
I had my choice, and one of the members of the panel, an old chief petty officer, said, "Why do you want to be in the Navy, son?" As soon as I told him that my brother had been in for several years, he barked that I was in the Navy, just like that.
All you had to do was ask.
All I had to do was ask. I was known as a selective volunteer.
Now, that seems like a bit of an oxymoron. What does that mean, exactly?
At that time, the Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force, if they were unable to meet their enlistment requirements for manpower, they had the option of drawing from the draft boards if they wished to do so. And that was the case in my instance, because the Navy had not had sufficient number of enlistments in Portland. And if the draftee had the physical qualifications for all of the services, then there could be a choice, as there was in my case.
Well, and you joined the Navy, but I guess some could say you got the best of both worlds because you got to spend a lot of time in airplanes, the PBY Catalina in particular. We're going to talk about that. But once you join the Navy, obviously anybody who ends up in the service in one way or another is going to have some training. There's going to be some boot camp. You're going to be put through the ringer pretty quick. Was there ever a point where you said, I don't know if I made the right decision here?
The only point that I would define in that regard is that during boot camp at Farragut, Idaho Naval Training Station, I contracted scarlet fever. And at that point, I wished I was home.
Well, I don't blame you. How long did that take you to get rid of?
I believe I was in isolation for about a month.
Did you have any sympathy at all from your fellow enlistees or draftees?
The shipmates who were in isolation with me, yes.
I bet when you finally got out, you heard about it.
That's right. There were about eight of us in the ward, and we all got pretty well acquainted during that month in there.
And I imagine it was not the warmest of weather in Farragut, Idaho.
Never is. Farragut, Idaho is north of Coeur d'Alene, about 40 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So perilously close to the Canadian border.
So naturally, they were preparing you to serve in the Pacific, where it's cold like that all the time.
Sure. Military thinking.
Well, and not long after that, after you moved on to the Naval Air Technical Training Center in Tennessee, in Millington, outside of Memphis, how did you end up learning Morse code? Where did that come from? Because I imagine you didn't grow up in Portland saying, someday I really hope to learn Morse code. That's a big dream of mine. How did that come about?
Well, that was, I would say that was purely involuntary. I recall,
you weren't a selective volunteer this time?
No, not for that. However, there was some qualification required in order to go to aviation radio school, and I cannot remember what that qualification was, but obviously I meant it because that's where they met it, because that's where they sent me. There were three schools there, I think, on that base, radio, aviation mechanics, and one other which escapes me. But my thing was radio to be, not through any choice of my own, but they told me that I was going to have to learn Morse code. And I thought, oh boy. But they made me understand that I would either learn it or probably stay there for the rest of the war, and I didn't want to do that.
Funny what a little motivation can do for you, huh?
Amen.
And now it's been almost 65 years. Well, it has been 65 years since then, and you still got Morse code, just like a second language.
It's still stuck up there, I can tell you.
Well, I'm holding proof of it in front of me here, because when Don showed up to do the show today, he handed me a slip of paper, and it has my name and our call letters, Paul Leffler, KMJ, translated into Morse code. Although I started to read it, and I said dot, dash, dot, dot. Or for my first name, dot, dash, dash, dot, and you corrected me. If you were to read my name in that Morse code, how would that sound there, Don?
Well, let's see. Da da dit, da da, di da, di da da dit. Excuse me, the last characters. Da did it. Sorry about that. That's an L.
And I'm sure there are a few fellow veterans out there who are understanding exactly what you're saying. But for those of us who've never had training with Morse code, that is Greek to us. Right. Was it something that once it started to click for you, it became real easy and almost like second nature?
No, it required repetition and a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it.
And how often, once you were actually deployed, how often did you end up using it? Was this a daily basis that this would be part of your experience?
Well, not daily, because when we were operating in the forward area, Saipan, we had only six aircraft, and we had nine crews, and we had to fly usually about two aircraft a day in support of the B-29s. And we had no reason to utilize our Morse code knowledge except during the times that we're flying. So we were communicating with other aircraft, largely through Morse code, but also with voice transmission.
Did you find that more often than not, what was intended to be transmitted was understood correctly, or did you ever have situations where things got a little jumbled in the process?
That obviously happens. There was another trick of which all radiomen were proud, and not anyone would understand this except one who knows Morse code. So we had a code among us. After spending 12, 14, 15 hours in the air, somebody would open up a transmitter and transmit did-did-did, three dots. Somebody else, several hundred miles away, would transmit did-did-did, four dots. Somebody else elsewhere would transmit two dots, did-did. And the last guy would transmit da. And that spells a bad word, which I cannot say.
And everyone knew what was coming once that process was begun.
Exactly.
So it just kind of kept you on your toes, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, provided a bit of a break.
Well, that is good. Speaking of breaks, we're about due for our first commercial break. But when we come back, we'll talk about some of the rescue missions that Don was involved in. And talk about that flying boat that's officially known as the PBY Catalina. It's not the stereotypical airplane when you think of something that servicemen spent time flying in World War II, but a very special aircraft, and Don has plenty of experiences to share with us. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes today. You're listening to News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Performed by our good friends at the Sounds of Freedom Band, a great local military band. You're listening to Hometown Heroes today. If you've never heard the show before, it's because we've moved. We have been on Sunday afternoons for more than a year. Now we're on Saturday afternoons from 1 to 2. I'm your host, Paul Leffler, and each week we visit with Valley veterans of World War II. This week, a Navy veteran, thus anchors away there. Don Meeker, though, spent some time not just at sea, but in the skies, taking off of ships in the Pacific Ocean at times, and there are a few hairy moments that he's going to share with us. Before we get to all of that and all your time aboard PBY Catalinas, some of the fun for a young man, and Don, you're 19 and 20 years old while you're in the Navy, and I imagine when you get your hands on a machine gun, especially a machine gun on an airplane and firing from a moving plane up in the sky, it's a little bit adventurous, a little bit of an adrenaline rush when you get to try that out for the first time?
It was a big thrill. It was a big thrill in firing from powered turrets on the ground at what might be moving targets on the ground as well as fixed targets. But firing from the air, from the aircraft, at targets that were being towed by other aircraft was, of course, a big thrill.
How was your marksmanship? Did it take you a while to figure out the lag time and where to aim?
Yes, it took a while to figure that out, although I'd been a hunter as a boy. But sure, you certainly have to learn to lead to target. If you don't, you're never going to hit it.
Did you develop a rivalry with the other members of your crew or the guys that you were training with as to who could get the most hits on that sleeve the other plane's dragging?
Yes, and each of us had the ammunition in each of our guns was color-coded so that the hits recorded on a sleeve could be attributed to whatever gun they came from.
Makes it kind of hard to cheat, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. If you're red and the other guy is green, it's hard to cheat.
Was there a prize that went to the victor in those competitions?
No, because we were all striving to acquire a third-class petty officer's stripe, which all of us did who graduated from gunnery school, yes.
And after that, that was near Jacksonville, Florida. Then you actually are in Jacksonville at the Naval Air Station there, and you finally see the plane that you would get to know very familiarly over the years ahead, and certainly the months ahead. What did you think the first time that you saw a PBY Catalina? Was it something along the lines of, what is that funny-looking thing? Were you a little bit taken aback?
In retrospect, I don't have in my mind any particular thought that I had, except looking back at it, I certainly probably, almost certainly thought that that sucker had to be the ugliest looking airplane I ever saw.
Pretty close to the spruce goose, huh?
That's right. But not nearly as big.
Thankfully. What, for our listeners, some of them, I think a lot from your generation are familiar with what a PBY is. But for those who've never seen one before or don't have an idea of its function, I'm sure you've been asked this before when you talk to people and you tell them what kind of plane you are on. How would you best describe the look, the feel, the function of a PBY Catalina flying boat?
Well, the principal feature about the ones in which I trained and later flew on duty is that the cat was made in two versions, one amphibious and the other non-amphibious. And it was in production for many, many years, starting in peacetime and continuing through the war years. And it was originally a consolidated aircraft design. The ones that we flew from Saipan were a updated version of the consolidated design and were actually built by Boeing in Canada. And they were flown down to us at San Diego, where we were staging, for further transfer on out into the Pacific. They had all the latest radio gear in them and the latest radar gear as well. But essentially the same airplane, but they were not amphibious. When we got back to base from a mission, we had to have a beaching crew that would affix rolling gear to the sides of the aircraft for us and under the tail. And then we'd be pulled up out of the water either with a tractor or with engine power.
But landing on the water, I'm sure, is a little nerve-wracking from time to time.
It is a little hairy. The ocean surface can be very deceptive. And we didn't like to have to land on glassy surface sea, because the PBY really was made to take a beating. And they were well able to do so by using, in effect, wave action to help bounce themselves into the air on takeoff. And so they were made to handle rough sea landings as well.
So you're one of the few people in the Navy that preferred a rocky sea to a smooth one.
That's correct. That is correct.
A little ironic there. Now, before, and I know there's some specific instances aboard PBYs and around them that you'll be sharing before we get to the end of this program today, but just generally speaking, describe for our listeners, if you can, your position on the PBY, what your duties were, and what that experience was like on your average mission from the time that you take off to you land.
I was a radio and radarman. As part of the crew, we had also a chief radio man who flew with us most days. We had a crew of about 7 to 9 on each of our missions. And my station aboard the aircraft was down inside the hull, practically under the starboard engine, and housed about 8 feet aft or to the rear of the pilot's compartment. My space was shared with the aircraft navigator. And in the after station, the blisters, so-called, most people that know PBY are familiar with the blisters, were two search stations. We spent an awful lot of time searching the ocean surface, either if we were on a specific search mission or if we were not on a specific search mission. We were charged with having to search at all times. We usually flew at about 600 feet.
And generally, you're searching for members of B-29 crews who had had to bail out?
Yes, or anything that we found we had to report.
But your chief function for your crew and the other crews that in your group was rescue, correct?
Yes, that's correct. We were, our mission was to act as we were known as Dumbo, to act as air sea rescue for the B-29 crews flying from the three Marianas Islands, Saipan, Guam, and Tinian.
Did that, I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes at the time and imagine what it would feel like. And you know what those B-29 crews are doing and what their mission is and what kind of flak they experience from time to time, what's at stake for them. Was there any pressure that you think you and your crewmates felt for if there are some guys in the water or if there are some guys that are out there, we better find them?
Yes. One mission that I recall, and I cannot recall whether we were on a search for some missing people or whether we just happened to find three missing people on a raft, and the surface that day was pretty choppy, choppier than we really wanted to use to land on. But it was choppy enough that there were whitecaps, and when we first, one of us spotted these three people and reported to the skipper, we went up to make a loop around to come back over them. And did so, and we dropped smoke marker and dice marker. And then went up to make another loop, come back, and we couldn't find him.
Mm.
Believe it. We were there for, a good hour, seemed like 3 hours, looking for them. Finally found them.
I was waiting for you to tell me the sharks got them.
No. We caught H-E-double-L later because those guys could not understand what the devil we were doing up there, just flying around.
They knew where you were, but you didn't know where they were.
Exactly.
What kind of reaction did you get when you finally rescued them? And maybe you can describe, you know what, I think we need to catch another commercial break, but when we come back, be thinking about this. You could explain to our listeners how that process works. Once you finally find them again, how do you get them off that raft and back to safety? We're going to get that explanation from World War II veteran Don Meeker when Hometown Heroes continues here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
The sailor boy, he was only three. Now he's on a battleship in his sailor suit. Just a great big sailor, but she thinks he's very cute.
With his bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue, she loves her sailor, and he loves her too.
Remember that one, Guy Lombardo, bell-bottom trousers. Or I understand from our guest today, Don Meeker, Navy veteran of World War II, you guys had a different name for the singer of that song.
Well, at least the band we referred to as Guy Lumbago.
Very funny, very funny. Don Meeker, as we've been hearing about, served on PBY Catalina flying boats in the Pacific during World War II. He was part of Rescue Squadron 2, VH-2, taking on and off the water at Tanapag Harbor Naval Air Station, which is the main harbor for Saipan. They were serving the B-29 squadrons operating out of Saipan, Tinian, and Guam at that time. You heard them describe their function to search, whether specifically or in general, for members of air crews who had been shot down or had to bail out or had crashed and were somewhere out at sea. And he started to tell us about one experience, and I asked him before the break to share what exactly was entailed once you get that PBY down on the water. How do you get those guys onto the airplane? And if the water's moving a little bit, I imagine it's a little harder than if the sea is calm.
Yes, yeah, certainly if there's happens to be a breeze blowing either cross current or from wherever it's blowing, it makes it more difficult for a pilot to keep the aircraft in position to jockey us into position in order to make a recovery. But we generally tried to bring the life raft or whatever other conveyance might be there, life jacket if need be, to try to bring them in onto the port side or left side of the aircraft, because the pilot's position, first pilot's position, was the left side of the aircraft. So he would kill the port side engine using the starboard engine for motive power to act against the rudder to change the direction of the airplane to try to bring the water conveyance up on the port side of the aircraft so that we could recover them from the port side blister.
This sounds like it may not be an exact science, like every rescue was different and posed different challenges and you had to really think on the fly.
That is correct, because the wind had a lot to do with it, and currents.
And how many men on your PBY crew?
Generally 7 to 9 of us.
Are you all pretty much in a frenzy at this point, doing something to try to get those guys on board?
Yes, we are. Everybody's pretty busy.
Were there ever situations, and most of these were in the daylight, correct, when you're rescuing?
Yes, that's correct.
I know you had some night takeoffs that maybe we'll talk about momentarily, but I'm just wondering, in doing so, in rescuing these men, and obviously they're in the water for a reason, either they had some aircraft problems or the problem was someone was shooting at them, was your crew ever a target of enemy forces? Did you guys ever find yourselves under fire in the process of a rescue operation?
No, we did not. Fortunately, in our particular case, in the case of our particular aircraft, we did not encounter enemy action. We went to islands which had some enemy soldiers still on the islands, but we never felt that we were in any danger. We'd gone to places like Marcus Island and Truck Island, Truck Lagoon, Hamitahan, Agrahan, but I think we were fired on from one of those lesser Marianas Islands, Hamitahan or Agrahan, a couple of times, but no, we were very fortunate. Some of our crews were fired upon, and we did lose one crew in 1945, but that was not due to enemy action, that was due to loss of an aircraft on the open sea.
How did that affect you when you heard about that? Because I'm sure that's a possibility that you had entertained in your mind that, you know, this isn't, when you're landing at sea, there's always some danger inherent in that process. When you found out about that, is it something that hit you like a ton of bricks?
Well, yes, because we lost, there were 10 people aboard the aircraft, we lost 7 of them. And
I imagine one of your other crews was probably tasked to go pick up the survivors.
No, as a matter of fact, I think those three remaining were found okay. by one of our air by a rescue aircraft, whether one of ours or not, I do not remember. But they were found by a rescue aircraft, and they were then later picked up by direction by a U.S. Navy submarine.
Uh-huh. Now, when you're rescuing a crew, and you were involved in several of these, and it's a different number of people each time, clearly, and you described one where you had circled for hours after finding them initially, couldn't find them, finally did again. What kind of greeting do you get when those guys get aboard and things calm down and you're taken back off and flying back to wherever you're going? What kind of reaction do you get from the rescued servicemen?
Well, of course, Paul, as you touched on a moment ago during the break, those guys could see us. And we had seen them. We'd found them. We weren't looking for them. We just happened to find them. And they could see us flying around up there and didn't know what we were doing. Why didn't we sit down and pick them up? And
I can't imagine what names they were calling you while you circled.
When we finally did, they did use some very salty language.
To which you responded?
There was not much of a response. They'd been out there some time, and we looked probably fat, dumb, and happy to them.
Was there any particular operation along those lines that really stands out in your memory as being very satisfying, something that you felt you and the entire crew were proud that you had been able to do?
Well, yes, nothing heroic, but our crew was, our aircraft was the lead aircraft in the squadron, and our skipper was a lieutenant commander, and not a very adept pilot, by the way. Although we had a very we had a very adept pilot as first pilot.
Aha! Uh-huh.
He had been an enlisted pilot in the Navy before the war even got started, and was required to take an officership as an ensign, which he did not want to do because I think he made more money as an enlisted pilot than he did as an ensign. But he was very good. He could fly anything. But we were, because we were the lead aircraft of the squadron, we were selected to do the first testing of a jet-assisted takeoff system. Because we had to do these long runs at night to get off the water with a full load of fuel, there was continual research being done to find a way to get us off the water more rapidly. So our aircraft was equipped with a set of JATO bottles. As I remember, there were four of them, two on each side.
And JATO stands for jet-assisted takeoff.
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
And there were four bottles, two on each side, aft of the blisters on the outside of the aircraft, and they were fired electrically from the pilot's control panel. So when the pilot would get the aircraft up on the step, as we referred to it, being on the step is the next thing to leaping into the air.
Right on the verge of getting off
right.
the water.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, he would fire those bottles. And I'm not sure of my numbers here, but I think that each of those bottles supposedly provided a boost of 330 horsepower for like 12 or 15 seconds. And it actually worked to just blow us off the water. And then those bottles would be discarded at sea because they were not recoverable.
Right.
And that was quite a thrill because we got a big boot in the tail.
I imagine that felt quite a bit different than your traditional takeoffs.
Oh, yeah, you bet, yeah.
Did it throw you out of your station or out of your headphones at your radio station?
No, I'll shove you back in the seat a little bit. Excuse me, but...
And I imagine that's something. With that much power, whoever's at the controls better be harnessing it the right way, because if you don't time it right or you're not aiming right, you might be in some trouble.
That's right. The aircraft has to be nearly ready to fly on its own at the time they fire those bottles.
And I'm assuming it always was in your experience?
Yes. Yeah.
Otherwise, you might not be sitting here talking to me.
Might not be.
Now, and we're going to have to take a break here in a second, but really quickly, you talked about taking off at night, and they wanted to get you off the water faster. Is that just because of the lack of visibility factor, that you don't know what you're going to encounter the longer you're on the surface?
Well,
or why was
yes,
that?
Partly that, yes. And the danger of floating objects in our path. Because
that you wouldn't
by the
see.
Time we get ready to get off the water, we're up at 85 miles an hour or so.
I'm guessing there's probably nothing that we could compare it to today that would quite compare to that feeling. I mean, I'm thinking about guys on jet skis or maybe windsurfers, but basically you were windsurfing at 85 miles an hour atop the crest of those waves. And then
that's right, aboard about 10 tons of airplane, probably 7 tons of airplane.
Quite the thrill ride.
Right.
Well, we've got a little time left here on Hometown Heroes today. We're going to take our final break, then come down the home stretch with Don Meeker, PBY Catalina crew veteran of World War II. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown heroes. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at KMJ580.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Saturday afternoon. If you've listened to this program for the first time, hope you enjoyed it. It's a brand new time now, every Saturday at 1 o'clock, moving from Sundays at 4. And if you have friends who've been listening on Sundays at 4 and you just caught the change, make sure they know about it, because we have a very loyal and vocal audience for this show, and that's much appreciated. And we just want to spread the word and make sure that our World War II veterans are honored, that we preserve their stories, and hopefully inspire some folks who are a little younger like I am in the process. It's been a pleasure visiting with Don Meeker today and reliving some of his experiences on PBY flying boats in the Pacific, part of a rescue squadron tasked with picking up air crew members who had to bail or were in the water for one reason or another. These planes took off and landed on the water. And Don had some other experiences that I think would be interesting to share before we're out of time here. One, you know, and we don't realize this in civilian life, and it's a good thing to talk about now when we have so many young men and women serving overseas at the moment. They have a lot more luxuries today than I think you had in 1944 and 1945. But there are some things that we civilians take for granted. And one that I think I would certainly take for granted is a nice cold glass of milk. And I understand that you got to the point there in Saipan where you just had to have a glass of milk.
I was desperate. I'd been a heavy milk drinker when I was at home as a young boy. And there was no cold milk to be had in Saipan. So I made an arrangement with another seaplane crewman who was assigned as a crew person aboard a four-engine flying boat called the Coronado, PB2Y3. And I told him that if he would bring me a quart of milk from Hawaii, keep it cold en route, I would pay him $5 for that quart of milk. And I did so.
And I don't know if I would pay $5 for a quart of milk today, but in 1945, $5, that was a pretty good chunk of change.
Yes, it was.
Was it worth it?
It was worth it, and I had it because I'd been very fortunate in the Quonset Hut poker game a couple of nights before that.
You could have been playing for milk if the milk was there waiting for you.
That's right.
Another experience brings to mind a different beverage that you were able to partake in and imbibe. And this came about in August of 1945. I often like to ask veterans who served in the Pacific what they remember about VJ Day. And you still remember that pretty clearly, the atmosphere and the celebration that ensued from the announcement.
Well, that's right. We had a once-weekly gathering up to that point at which we were entitled to, each of us on the island were entitled to, as I remember, we had to buy it, two cans of beer a week. And that was the high point of our week, because it gave us a chance to get together and swap stories and lie to each other and so forth. But at BJ Day, when that came to pass, we were allowed 4 cans of beer that day. And that was quite enough beer all in one day to make quite a celebration for all of us.
I imagine your body wasn't quite prepared for that.
I'll say not.
But you still remember it, so that's a good sign.
Yeah.
It didn't knock you out too bad. Now, when Don showed up for the program today, he wore a sweatshirt one of his fellow veterans gave him that on the front has a picture of his PBY crew, including Don. He's wearing a hat with a photo of a PBY on the front. Above that, his air crew wings that he earned 65 years ago in Jacksonville, Florida, but somehow are polished where the gold is sparkling in my eye right now. And also a book entitled PBY, the Catalina Flying Boat, published by the Naval Institute Press. But I understand the way that you ended up with that book was a pretty roundabout fashion.
That's right. This book had been in the rotational shelves of a library in, I think, Gig Harbor, Washington, up near Tacoma, Olympia. And my wife and I were on a 50th anniversary cruise to Mexico from San Diego on a cruise ship. And I was wearing my PBY Heroes hat. And another passenger said, "You flew in Catalinas?" I said, "Yes, sir, I did." He said, "When I get back home, I'm going to send you a book that I have." He said, "I don't want it back." I said, "I'll return it." He said, "I don't want it back. It's yours." And that gentleman did send that to me. It was a very kind gesture. I thank him very much.
And you read through it quickly, and you still have it. And I imagine to be able to read that so many decades after your experiences, it probably brought a lot of those memories back, just reading that book.
Oh, yes, and I learned a lot of things that were done by PBYs that I didn't know about before.
When you look back now, and I'm sure at the time, you're living in the moment. I talked to so many veterans who say they never really thought about what could have happened to them. When you look back now, do you think someone was looking out for you? Do you feel fortunate that you encountered so little enemy action, and that with all the takeoffs and landings on the seas of the Pacific that you were able to be here today?
Yes, sir, because there were some hairy times, and not particularly so for our crew. But yes, I feel very, very fortunate to have lived through it, and for so many years as I have now at the age of 84.
Well, I'm thankful for that, too. And I want to thank you for your service to our country, for taking the time to share it with us today. We've got a couple minutes left in the show. I often like to ask veterans what they think, why they think it's important for us to remember World War II and what the men and women of your generation did. 16 million Americans served in World War II. More than 400,000 gave their lives for our freedom during that time period. Why do you think it's important for us to remember World War II?
Because we must do everything that can be done to avoid it happening again, because what happened in World War II would be minuscule compared to what would happen in another one.
With the technology improving, weaponry, and
right,
the situation in the world
right
today.
It would be utter mayhem worldwide.
Well, I can agree with you in praying that that will never happen. And what you and men and women like you did more than 65 years ago has helped us ensure the freedom that we have today. So, Don, again, thank you for your service to our country. Thanks for being here today. And if you want a glass of milk after the program, it might not cost you $5. Don Meeker has been our guest today on Hometown Heroes. We'll be back at this same time, and mark it on your calendars from now on, Saturdays at 1 o'clock from here on out. Remember, if you have a veteran that you think I ought to catch up with, you can always email me, paul@kmj580.com. We also have previous versions of the program, past episodes available online at kmj580.com. Thanks so much for listening today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.